Welcome to the Global CISO Forum, the podcast for information security executives.
Welcome to the Global CISO Forum podcast. I'm your host, Amber Pedroncelli. With me today is Mr. Zachary Mitchum. He is the Chief Information Security and Compliance Officer, and he's also a finalist for the CISO Awards this year, presented by EC Council. Welcome to the show, Zachary.
Thank you, Amber, and thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for making time for us. I know you're very busy. Looking at your job title, so you're CISO and compliance officer for North Carolina Central University. You've worked in education kind of on and off for a long time. Tell me what that's like.
Well, I've worked at being in the military. I've gotten different assignments, having worked with University of Tennessee in Knoxville for 4 years, and I've also worked with the University of Maryland University College over in Bosnia and Herzegovina, and I worked with University of North Carolina Wilmington for 10 and a half years, and now I'm at North Carolina Central University.
You worked for the University of Maryland in Bosnia?
Oh yeah. Well, the way that works is when you're in the military, if you have special skill sets that are required, they'll look at that and they'll leverage that. So I worked as a associate professor, assistant professor of military science over in the University of Tennessee in Knoxville, and I was also trained as a certified information security and management officer. They call it IMO. Information management officer. So I taught computer science, fundamentals of computer science, while I was in Bosnia on my tour there.
Oh, wow. That must have been quite an experience.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. I mean, I had a captive audience. The class studied, and they weren't going anywhere, that's for sure. So.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's cool. So you've had a lot of kind of mix of military and education then, is what you're saying.
Well, yeah, I was 20 years as an infantry officer with the U.S. Army.
Wow.
And while doing that, you have to have a functional area. In the Reagan era, they started downsizing the military. And so as such, you had to pick up a functional area. And I was functional area 53 is what it's called, systems automation officer. And I was school trained at Fort Gordon, Georgia, School of Information Technology. So that was my secondary. While we're not fighting wars, we have to have something else to do, right?
And it seems like you stayed pretty busy.
Oh, yeah, no doubt.
So tell me about your role now. Is it still related to the military, or are you out?
No, I'm out. Yeah, I was out in 2001. I retired in 2001. Yeah, from that time forward, I've worked in disparate systems, but in technology. I was the director of network services that dealt a lot in security at the New Hanover Regional Medical Center in Wilmington, North Carolina, about 2.5 years. And then I worked as an assistant, senior Army instructor for a ROTC assignment. That was when we were going through the 2001 era, where, you know, we had the war going on and all this terrorism, and decided to go back and help those young kids navigate through that. And I did that for about 2.5 years. Then I got back into higher education with the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. And I was there for 10.5 years as the information security officer, chief information security officer there.
I see. So you've done a lot of educating in your career.
No doubt, yeah.
How has that helped you? Do you still do that in your role?
Yeah, I mean, because it makes you well-versed in being a subject matter expert on the things you've taught, and you become comfortable with a different group of people, whether it be academicians with PhDs to laymen, right? So it gives you a comfort level that you can speak articulately to whatever audience you're talking to at the kind of and presenting the type of material you're presenting, right? So I'm not intimidated with anybody with a PhD, and I'm not patronizing anyone that doesn't have it in a layman terms. It keeps me on my toes and keeps me up to date on current trends, things like that.
Yeah, so that has it come in handy for your end user training?
Yes, no doubt. I mean, that's what we do is we call it secure the human when it comes to educating my constituents, especially when it comes to things like teaching phishing exploits and social engineering and understanding proclivities of human behavior and natural instincts and just simply telling people what's in it for them, right? It's a communal thing.
Mm-hmm.
So if someone breaks into our computer, guess what? Their information's in that same computer, right? So it behooves them to be as secure as possible and practice good security hygiene, if you will.
Mm-hmm. So a buzzword of the last couple of years, probably 5 years at this point, has been insider threat. Is that something that you've had to deal with? I mean, probably as a CISO, but any specifics you can share with us?
Well, not specifics that happened to me, but tangentially, one of the largest one you've heard of is the Snowden case that was affecting our federal government that I worked with the DIS, I mean DISA, and the in my role as a security officer in Bosnia. I worked with DISA, and I also worked with the intelligence, DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, and that was, to me, one of the most perilous things that have happened to us in the last 20 years, whereby you had a person at that level with a top-secret security, sensitive compartmentalized information clearance provide that kind of information to a public sphere. That was reckless, you know. And in the vein of whistleblowing, there's a certain way to do that, but that wasn't the right way because it put a lot of our soldiers at risk and a lot of our intelligence people at risk by doing that. So
yeah,
to me, it hadn't happened at that level, but definitely that's one of the largest ones that I'm aware of that had an association with my previous employer, Department of Defense.
Did that heighten your kind of awareness of that problem in your other jobs?
Well, we've always had to be heightened about, you know, insider threats because you have the keys to the kingdom, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, think about it. Who's watching who? And that's always the case when you have a system like the mandatory access controls of the military. Someone's always got to be vigilant about who's doing what. And that upper level discretionary non-discretionary type of oversight is very important to us at all levels of security. So,
okay, that makes sense. I'm just always curious about that because it seems like sometimes, in my opinion, and this is just, you know, sort of my view as an outsider, it seems like security programs are designed for perfectly ethical people, and I just wonder sometimes what the contingencies are when that's not the case.
Is that ever the case? You said perfectly ethical. That's oxymoronic, right?
Right. No, that's
perfectly
true.
Perfectly ethical? Are you kidding? That doesn't exist. I don't know if that's ever the case unless you're talking about the faith that I'm in. That's the most ethical person that I can maintain. He had maintained his integrity.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I don't trust anyone when it comes to that. No.
Okay. Okay, yeah, I see that.
That's why it's pretty, you asked that question, and I'm counter to a lot of my colleagues when they talk about ethical hacking, right?
Right.
And I always come back to the point of that Snowden because in his mind, he was doing the right thing, but that's against the law. I mean, if you go with 18 U.S. Code 2510 or 1030, surreptitiously getting into someone's network without their express permission is against the law. I don't care who you are. Even trying to prove a concept, that's of no consequence. Now, if I paid you to do that, that's not hacking at all. That's just information that I passed on with you, whether it's a black hat or a white hat engagement, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that ethical hacker has issues associated to me as a security guy going back since 1981 that I think a lot of my colleagues, I know what it means, but it's not to me. It's just like a jumbo shrimp. It's oxymoronic to me. It's not something that I would ever, like you came back with the idea of being perfectly ethical. No such thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it's no such thing as a white hat hacker or ethical hacking. and as an absolute form, right?
Well, as a representative of EC Council, creators of the certified ethical
look,
hacker.
I do understand the concept, but I understand 100% the concept, right?
Yeah. I get what you're saying.
But if you were to hack into any system, being a good Samaritan, for instance, you could find yourself in jail depending on who you hacked.
That's true. And
you might want to tell them before you do any of that, right?
Right. And if you're prosecuted or not, you're still breaking the law. So, yeah, point
taken.
You're
breaking the law. That's the law. Yeah. That's all I'm saying. Yeah. And by the way, I am a member of the CE Council in terms of being a certified CISO, so I understand the whole concept. I totally support it.
Oh, I know.
And we need more of them. We need more of them.
You're one of the first CISOs, if my records are correct, I think. So you were.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You were back in the
grandfathered.
In the day,
yep. You were grandfathered in. So we appreciate that quite a bit. I'm glad I asked you about insider threat. That's a very interesting perspective. And then just keeping kind of on that same thing, working at universities, does that pose, I mean, you've got all those smart kids running around being reckless, right? I mean, is that a special population to try to deal with?
Without question, not just the kids, but you have professors as well. You know, academia is supposed to be a collaborative and open environment by nature of what we're doing with the type of discovery and social discourse, that kind of thing. And intellectual discourse, but obviously we have to maintain security where it's necessary. So we restrict a lot of things that a lot of schools leave open. We don't. Some schools don't even have firewalls, if you can believe that. And some schools don't believe in peer-to-peer file sharing being turned off. We turn those functions off in case by case because it is a legitimate means of communicating information peer-to-peer, but it's only done here on a case-by-case basis. We don't have many instances where script kiddies is what you're alluding to, try to break into the network and give themselves all A's and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But I've heard of cases where that was the case.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
situations where that was the case.
Yeah, I guess in my imagination, it's just like kids would think it'd be cool to hack their school and, you know, show that they're smarter than the administration or something. Yeah.
Have you ever heard of the Morris Worm?
I think so, but I'm a little fuzzy on the details.
1987, in proof of concept, this guy, probably they suspect he was a student at MIT, did that exact thing, and that's where they came up with the first virus, if you will, from a student that, again, trying to prove to the community that distributed computing and it isn't all as hacked out to be if you don't take serious security serious. So the Morris Worm was that kind of thing you're alluding to with college people or insiders doing certain things.
Yeah. Students just, you know, they have more time on their hands and they're young, and I can see them being different than trying to secure a corporation where,
well,
you know,
keep in mind, you got graduate students that aren't young, and you got
true.
Non-traditional students that are 50 years old, law students, they're grown people. So when we think of college, that was a flaw of mine when I first came in with the presumption or assumption that all college kids were 18, but no, we have people from the full gamut, on adults, college professional. Mm-hmm. Doctors, that kind of thing.
The administration, yeah. Sounds like a challenging place to work.
As well, yeah.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. So tell me how you got into security.
Well, again, I was formally trained in the military in 1981 with operational security. Mm-hmm. That started with just dealing with, you know, computing was at its very infancy stage, and they had a thing they call it the Army Combat Service Support Computer System, right? It's called a TACS. And as a officer that was, we call an administration officer, S1, I was responsible for the TACS machine. And we also had a thing called COMSEC, Communication Security, that dealt with radio communications, SINGAR, single channel ground and air radio systems. And that's where I got my formal training. And then it just built on that. It was before any certifications came about, like CISSP, this 1981. So, and I had to catch up to get certified to do things I had been doing, certifying skiffs since 1994 and stuff like that, right?
Wow.
So it's pretty funny to me that they were asking me for certifications when I was certified by the Department of Defense Information Intelligence Agencies, right?
Yeah, your knowledge predated all the certifications.
Yeah, that was funny, right?
I bet.
But yeah, I catch up, I stay current, so I can appreciate what's happening. Yeah. But that's how I got my background.
Wow, so you have
that was my background, yeah.
Yeah, you have a very long career in information security. What keeps you going? What keeps you motivated?
Well, I mean, just seeing the evolution of things that have taken place and issues that have been resolved and some of them that have not been resolved, and I like to write articles about them and challenge the status quo, because we look at things so linearly instead of abstractly. For instance, when we have cases like breaches, and we use that term so loosely, I mean, breach. Okay, so I would imagine that a major corporation has a breach of security. That's why you have to use precise terms precisely. A security breach probably takes place in a corporation every day. That's different than a data breach or exposure or going on. Data breaches are different than security breaches. For instance, if someone found through SECM a virus on a computer, certainly they didn't put it there, right? So that's a breach of security. And that's why it is. It's definitely a breach of security. If you didn't put the virus there, how did it get there, right?
Right.
So that's the way I teach. I say, look, we have a security breach almost daily, but we don't have data breaches that often. So we have to be very careful about the way we explain ourselves in our industry, right? And it's a very fine line. Target, that was a data breach, right? And so files were disclosed and, a lot of harm. But you mean to tell me there are no viruses in anybody's network on any given day?
Right.
Huh. I've never heard that. No,
I haven't. I've never heard it explained that way. That's an interesting way to think of it. And if now that I'm going to, go and read a bunch of articles, and it's just going to throw around data breach and security breach and seem like it's the same thing.
Let's do it for your computer. Just run a scan. I don't know what you use, McAfee or, Symantec. Just run a scan. If you came up with one virus, guess what? Somebody put it there, right?
Right. Security breach.
Or breach. Security breach. Exactly. Because we put those controls in place specifically for that. Firewalls, right? And IPSs and IDA. So if it circumvented that, that means you had a breach in your security.
Huh. That is
but
interesting.
But not a data particularly. Yeah. You don't
right.
have
no
a data,
data was,
breach. You just had,
yeah.
No, doesn't mean a data was exfiltrated or anything, but you did have a security breach.
Right. Could have been, but probably not.
Could. Well, you definitely had a security breach if you got a virus. Okay. No if, whereas, buts about it, right?
Yep. Right. Huh. I like that. I like that
unless
perspective.
Unless you're an insider and you put it there, right?
Right.
Which in that case is a security breach too, right?
It's true. It's just not an accident.
That's right.
Well, that's cool. I like how you think of that. So how do you use breaches? So, like when a big breach makes the news, how do you use that?
Education, obviously. I mean,
just education,
Do we want this to happen to us? And you're not trying to, like, Peter and the wolf, skies fall and all that. But you just simply say, look, in order for us to prevent these types of things from happening to us, we have to maintain a certain kind of security culture in our environment. And, all we have to do is follow standard procedures, like with the ISO 27002 mapping of things like the NIST, 61, 83, 18, and all that. So, I mean, those standards are already out there for a reason. And get senior management buy-in, right? So, I mean, if the president's not willing to go out, I usually have people not even want to change their own password. Can you believe that? I want a non-expiring password. Really? Come on. So it sets the tone for that kind of thing happening.
Is that like an executive-level person asking for that kind of thing?
the CEO of one of my schools. Like, I'm like, are you kidding? That's an occupational hazard, right? Having to tell the king.
Right.
That's a bad idea, right?
Truth to power right there. Yeah, so.
Without question, yeah.
You're too important to have to change your password, but do you understand that your data needs to be more protected probably than anybody else's? I mean, I can see.
Because of whaling, right?
Right.
You're the big fish.
Right.
And actually, guess what? You've had situations, you could just Google it, where schools have had their presidents breached for that, and they've lost money like $2 million because they got fallacious information that they felt came from the chancellor or whatever.
Uh-huh.
They bit, and there you go. Because they didn't have a lot of buy-in from their higher management, the upper echelon. Yeah.
Right. Those guys don't show up to security awareness training and don't think much applies to them.
They should be the first one. I had some chancellors that were outstanding, though. They would do that. We had a program, the Chancellor Safety and Security Council, and they would come in and open that for that reason. But, I mean, it evolved over time. We had several chancellors. There you go. Not here at this school, but other schools, right?
Right.
And there you go. But, yeah, you're right. You need to be the one opening the security council, the security events that we have to show that you support. And whatever the king supports, everybody else falls in line, right?
Right. So how do you get that? Is that a skill you've had to learn, or have you always been pretty good with that?
Well, it's about the login, what's in it for me. And I have it depends on how serious the organization is about security. If they bury the security officer under some innocuous branch of their IT, you won't. But if you're very serious, you report to the very minimum, the CIO, and then you're able to speak to Board of Trustees, the Chancellor himself or herself, and there you go. But if you're burying the CISO under several layers of, bureaucracy, you're not serious about it, you know. So, yeah, that's the way I've always approached it. I've been pretty successful over my 16 years working on higher education.
Yeah. I mean, you're still doing it, so you must be doing a good job.
Yeah. I started two programs at two major universities, so they didn't have any, and they started, and when I left, it was a vivacious environment. We were award-winning, as a matter of fact. We won some awards at some schools. So.
Wow.
I think I was pretty instrumental in that happening. It just didn't happen by itself, but it was a collective effort on everybody's part, the whole environment.
Is that a role that you like to do, to sort of build something as opposed to inheriting a big system?
Scratch.
Yeah, you like it from
scratch. Exactly, because there's nowhere you can go but up, right?
Right, right.
I mean, if it's terrible, it's because of you.
That's true, too.
If it's good, it's because of you. There was nothing here before you got here. So if it's bad, it's always like your parents say, always leave things better than you left it, right? So it's a testament on, how business is conducted, whether you've done audits and you were successful, and it speaks for itself. It's proof's in the pudding, right? So you look at your past, you say, have you been in the news? No. Unless it was positive. Have you had any major breaches? No. Unless and there you go. So it's pretty easy to track when you've made a impact, as opposed to you assuming somebody else's role. So I always like just starting from scratch, right? Because it's like baking a cake. You don't bake the cake in the middle of the cake, right? I'll take over from here.
Right, I got it.
Cake's all
right. Yeah. So do you get to do kind of the hands-on technology stuff nowadays? Or?
Well, I've worked from the keyboard to the boardroom. That's what you do starting out. You have to do scans like common vulnerability exposure scans with Qualys. I've done those, and we have things with CompuTrace, Absolute Software. I'm still technical.
Yeah.
No, I'm not separated from, by any means. I have to teach these guys some of them. Some of them come in very high end technically, but they don't understand the full gamut of what CISOs do. They think that that's all they do is the keyboard, and that's not what I do anymore. I hired another person, and that changed over some of those operational day to day things over to them. Why I'm having to create programs and security plans and strategic goals and supporting the chancellor and having to speak and do other things. And this school, I love it because my university now, they appreciate my role and they understand what I'm doing and they're very satisfied in what I'm doing.
Well, that's great to hear. I always wonder if CISOs, because, so many of you guys start out really technical, and then your job role kind of brings you further and further away from that. And I always wonder if you kind of miss it on some level, just being at the keyboard.
No, I don't miss
like
it
said.
At all because you have
still
to
do it. Yeah,
I don't miss it by any stretch. But I mean, it's not as complicated. A lot of people paint it out to be. You kick off a scan with an automated system that's technologically astute, some AI. It tells you what the vulnerabilities are. You go through and do your little screening to see if these are actual vulnerabilities or they're false positives, and then you send it out to a system administrator to remediate. Then you check again. Okay, that's operation, right?
Right.
It's not like I had to painstakingly go through 3 billion of line of code to determine what a vulnerability was. It's an automated system, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's Nessus, Qualys, you know, Metasploit, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people try to play that up. Now, one of the things that has to happen when you do computer security incident response, which I'm one about 50 people certified by the School of Engineering at Institute at Carnegie Mellon, computer security incident handlers. Now, there's a certification for that through GIAC, but the one that kicked it off was through the SEI, the School of Engineering, Software Engineering Institute in Carnegie Mellon. And it's like 50 worldwide or something.
Hmm.
And I'm one of those. But to be able to go in and do artifact analysis and root cause and incident investigations, I like doing that. That's what my role as a CISO is, very rewarding. And thankfully, we don't have to use that role much, but I'm competent and confident in what I do in that respect.
Yeah, like, thankfully, you don't have to use it much. But, yeah, that's a... It's a cool thing to be very competent in. I can see that being a way to stand out on your resume. Not that you need that, but it sounds like you're really good at staying abreast of everything that's going on. Do you have a lot of resources to keep learning? Is that something that you focus on?
Yeah, I mean, you get the Sean's CISSP. You have to stay abreast of the current trends. You know, you read, you write. You go to conferences, you talk to your peers. I was invited to the GDS Information Security Summit out in Austin, where I spoke with my colleagues about things in higher education. I was one of the representatives there. And we had other industries like Department of Defense. You had, what is it, the one with the faucet, Kohler? Faucets, that they were there, GE.
Hmm.
And just be able to do think tank type things and talking and discussing things in various areas. Ransomware is ransomware, whether it was at Humana or whether it's at a university. It's just different variants of it, right? WannaCry, crypto. Yeah, same thing.
Yeah. Yeah, you can learn from anyone, basically, is what you're saying.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. I mean, since I run the conferences here at EC Council, I really appreciate that conferences are a good way to stay abreast of your industry and everything. So, yeah.
Without question.
We agree. Well, your application or your nomination for CISO of the Year is outstanding, and I hope that I get to give you a big trophy in Atlanta in a couple months here.
I'm just appreciative that someone saw fit to nominate me and be in that category with those kind of guys. There's some very impressive guys that on that list.
So you probably haven't even seen your nomination, have you?
Not necessarily, no.
Nope. Someone did it for you. Yeah, well, I could send it to you. It was great. The committee rated it very, very highly, so, you know, you're definitely in the running. I hope that you can make it to the awards ceremony. And
okay.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for taking the time, and congrats on being a finalist.
Okay. Well, thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to it.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in to another edition of the Global CISO Forum, the podcast for information security executives.